I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Heather Hying and Brett Weinstein. Heather Hying and Brett Weinstein are evolutionary biologists who have been invited to address the U.S. Congress, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Education, and have spoken before audiences across the globe. They both earned PhDs in biology from the University of Michigan, where their research on evolution and adaptation earned awards for its quality and innovation. They've been visiting fellows at Princeton University, and before that were professors at the Evergreen State College for 15 years. They resigned from Evergreen in the wake of 2017 campus riots that focused in part on their opposition to a day of racial segregation and other college equity, in quotes, proposals. They co-host weekly live streams of the Dark Horse podcast, and they are the authors, co-authors of a new book, A Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century, Evolution and the Challenges of Modern Life. So first off, thank you for your great work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having us, Derek.
Yes, thanks for having us.
So my first question is, what does the title mean? And I'll say the title again. A Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century, Evolution and the Challenges of Modern Life. And then also I want to take a quote from the book, and if you can respond to both of these, that'd be great. The quote is, "Some look back at our species' successes, such as the success of the Beringians, and imagine that we can master nature, that we are in control of it. But we are not, and never will be. The consequences of this bad assumption account for many of our problems today. The only way to course correct is to understand the true nature of what we are, what we might be, and how we might apply this wisdom to our benefit." So really, what is our true nature? And, well, sorry, go ahead. Just take those.
Let me take the title, and then maybe Brett will respond to that quote. A Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century refers to that sort of iconic vision of what humans used to be, right? Hunter-gatherers on the African savanna. And that, you know, frankly, often romanticized vision of what humans were has been used to create things like, you know, the paleo diet, the paleo lifestyle. It imagines that there is one moment from our past to which we are best adapted, and that anything that has happened since then is either, you know, gravy or something to which we are specifically not going to be adapted. And really, as we say in the book, we could have named it an agriculturalist's guide to the 21st century, or a post-industrialist's guide, or even a mammal's guide or a fish's guide. The idea being that the term of art in evolutionary biology is the environment of evolutionary adaptedness, is the environment to which a particular organism species is evolved. But of course, in fact, we have many environments of evolutionary adaptedness. And while that romanticized image of hunter-gatherers on the African savanna is accurate, you know, we did live that life for some period of time. But we have also, almost all of us, been agriculturalists, for instance, for 10 to 12,000 years, during which time much has happened evolutionarily. And even the last 150 to 200 years of being post-industrial has had much opportunity for evolutionary change. So we are trying to both update the reader's understanding of what it means to be products of evolution and to provide a toolkit to understand what humans are, and also provide some insight into how the hypernovelty and extraordinarily fast change in the modern world is leading us into conclusions and endpoints that may be all too final.
All right, maybe I'll address the quote. And the real question is, how are we to understand the issue of control of nature? And it is important to recognize that human beings are excellent at exerting control. But this results in a kind of hubris, a belief that the entire mechanism can be controlled and mastered. And this is folly. We are built to do something more akin to surfing the environments that we are in, rather than controlling them, rather than trying to steer the waves to our will. Figuring out how the waves work and utilizing them to our advantage is what we should do. And the problem is that when you attempt to exert control in a complex system, what you do is you create a huge number of cascading downstream effects. So if you were to stand on a street corner in any city in the developing world and watch people go by, you would be able to observe a tremendous amount of pathology, right? That would not be the case. If you stood in a forest and you watched creatures, you would probably spend all day and not see a single identifiable pathology. But for human beings living in the modern world, there are all these things that are just simply wrong. And whether it's the person talking to them mysteriously on the street corner or people whose weight is completely out of control, the fact is there are things that we have introduced in our environment, and almost all of them were imagined to be solutions to problems. And what they've done is created a whole set of new problems that now demand their own solutions. And as we become wiser as a species, if we become wiser as a species, what we will do is we will start to consider those unintended consequences before we take the action and prepare for the possibility that they will emerge and prepare ourselves to reverse course if we discover them.
So that is so, both of those are so beautiful and beautifully succinct that I almost don't want to ask you to say more about them, but can you give some examples of some unintended consequences from, well, there's two directions. One of them is, this reminds me of a line by David Ehrenfeld, who said, just because we can commit minor miracles, we think we can commit major miracles. And what he meant by that was, just because we can do open heart surgery, which is certainly a minor miracle, therefore we think we can manage an entire forest or something like that.
Oh, that's beautifully said.
That is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Ehrenfeld's great.
But go ahead. Let me give you an example that we've become aware of, that is Heather and I have become aware of in the last few years, the last couple of years, in fact, which has to do with the situation surrounding what's called malocclusion, which is the failure of our teeth to emerge in the right places and for our jaws to meet in the right way. And if you have encountered the world of modern orthodontia, you will probably have heard, or at least heard implied, the idea that what has happened is something has gone wrong with our genes that is causing our teeth to end up in the wrong places. And aren't we lucky to have this technology that allows us to actually move teeth and put them in the right places so that you can then go a lifetime with your jaws functioning properly? The problem is, this is a nonsense story. It never made any sense that our genomes would have gone haywire in this regard so rapidly. There's no evidence for it. And what we know is that essentially, as people live lifestyles that look closer to our ancestors, their teeth work just fine. They look like the teeth of creatures that you would find in nature. And what has in fact happened, apparently, is we have altered the diets of very young children. We have altered the diets. We have actually effectively pre-chewed their food and delivered it to them in such a soft form that the developmental process that is supposed to result in the strengthening of muscles and the forming of bone does not work correctly. Our faces effectively collapse. And then later in life, that collapsed face, which doesn't have room for your wisdom teeth, may not have room for all your regular teeth, may space them inappropriately and aim them in the wrong direction. What we do is we exert forces on these teeth, and we take advantage of a hidden evolutionary mechanism, a mechanism that actually constantly adjusts the position of your teeth through life, and we use it to move them around. And then we effectively get your teeth well organized in jaws that are still the wrong shape. And this has all sorts of implications for health, all sorts of things like sleep apnea are downstream of these effects. So what we're doing is simply creating pathology on top of pathology rather than looking at the root cause. And the root cause, once you spot it, tells you the right solution is not orthodontia. The right solution is to correct the diets of very young children so that they don't require orthodontia when they mature.
Yes, I would add to that that there is wisdom in what has been, and there is promise in what is in the future. And abandoning all of the past is an error, and imagining that anything that could happen in the future is bad or inappropriate is also an error. So thinking, well, modern medicine has done us great good. Let us continue to make life easier for ourselves by giving our children soft food, turns out to have been an error in thinking. Because as it turns out, chewing on hard things as very young children was actually a necessary part of jaw and tooth development. And no one knew that at the time. It's not like this was an act of evil. It was an act of confusion and ignorance of evolutionary process. And that's going to be what so many of these things are. So another example would be, you know, antibiotics, which are one of the great, you know, miraculous successes of Western medicine, really have saved countless lives. And yet then they were overapplied, and they were used in place of older solutions rather than in tandem with older solutions, like spend time outside, put sick people outside. And as a result, we have over-antibiotic'd both ourselves and our livestock, and we've made ourselves and the environment sicker as a result.
I want to go back to the teeth for a second. And what sort of hard things would a child 15,000 years ago have been chewing on? And like at what age? Is it 6 months, 9 months, year? And what are they chewing on that's so hard?
Well, it would have varied by culture. And, you know, of course, we don't actually know what the cultures, how varied the cultures were 15,000 years ago, but there certainly would have already been a tremendous amount of variation. But, you know, roots and bones.
Hard vegetable matter primarily. I would direct people, if they're interested in this question, the ultimate source is an orthodontist. He's actually a second generation orthodontist. His father pioneered this line of inquiry. But Mike Mew has done this work extensively. And at the point that we found Mike Mew and began to have all the questions that were haunting us about orthodontia and why it was so, why it was increasing in necessity answered, we discovered that Mike had actually done much of the evolutionary work necessary to see this picture. It's rare that somebody whose specialty isn't evolution really gets the puzzle, but he had done it very well. So check out Mike Mew. And actually, he does have a lot of information, anthropological information, on what a normal diet would look like that would generate a healthy jaw structure.
I guess just one more thing about teeth. People have been fed an image of pre-industrial people largely as being people with a lot of malocclusion, occlusion, you know, people with distorted faces, with teeth that were broken and decrepit and falling out. And the fact is, when you go back to, you know, the very unfortunate fact is that we have a lot of museum collections from older times of people, and you don't start to see this kind of mess in the mouth and the jaws of people until around the Victorian era.
No, and in fact, when Europeans discovered the New World and the populations of it, one thing that we get wrong is that the Europeans did understand those in the New World as effectively culturally primitive, but they also regarded them as physically beautiful specimens, because in fact they didn't have problems like malocclusion. They had diets that were well matched to their genomes, etc.
At the risk of sucking up too much, I want to go back to a comment you said a moment ago, which is in many ways I think the essence of the book and the essence of why I enjoy talking with you, which is you said he was able to answer all of our questions that we had about orthodontia. And that's one of the things I found delightful about this book, is that you are asking all sorts of questions about sleep, about relationships, about all sorts of things, and putting them into this evolutionary biology frame. And I just, this level of curiosity pulls, I think, the reader through the book.
Well, that's great to hear. I will say we've had this experience. We had it ourselves as we began to realize how much power there was in an evolutionary framework to answer questions that we all frankly have. And basically, if you don't pick up an evolutionary framework, at some point you probably learn to stop asking because you're sick of not being able to get to an answer that's satisfying. But once you see that the evolutionary toolkit is not some remarkable collection of erudite things, it's actually quite intuitive, and it does allow you to navigate even your own life. It provides a lot of grounding for alterations that really change how satisfied you end up being, how healthy you are, how one will raise their own children. And so it has been very satisfying for us to see that curiosity actually leads somewhere. And we know that we had hundreds of students for whom it was life-changing. And this book is really the opportunity to take that toolkit and bring it to a wider audience.
So I want to say one comment, and then after that I would like to ask you for some more examples from daily life about how evolutionary biology and evolution and our perhaps mismatch, more examples like the orthodontia example. But in any case, before then, I want to tell you about a conversation I had with a friend of mine who's a fisheries biologist. And we were sitting by the ocean one day, and he was chatting with me about how sharks have rough skin. And because of the difference between laminar and turbulent flow, the rough skin actually makes it so it takes less energy for them to swim faster. And I know that this guy goes to church every Sunday. So I said to him, do you believe in some sort of intelligent design? Because that's really smart. And his answer was one of the most beautiful answers I've ever gotten, which is he said, there is great intelligence in time.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's beautiful.
That is beautiful. And well, that's not anywhere where I thought you were going. And usually such stories end with chalk it up to cognitive dissonance, right? You know, people have to hold things in their heads that just don't align with one another. But the idea that there's great intelligence in time, this is the evolutionary perspective indeed. And, you know, part of the thesis of the book is the rate of change that humans are enacting on ourselves and on the planet is even too fast for us to keep up with at this point. That our lineage has been around as every extant lineage on the planet for 3.5 billion years, give or take. And, you know, humans have been in our modern form for 200,000 years, give or take. And we are so much software. We are so much more software than hardware compared to, say, a shark, for sure. And we are best in the world on the planet at niche switching, at changing between habitats and between plans and between ideas. And yet even we have accelerated things to such a degree that it's going to be very hard for us to pull out of this.
I would also add, I must say, Heather and I have no trouble sitting down with intelligent religious people and not tripping over the differences in our worldview. And after a lot of thinking about this, there's a false division between us, right? It is certainly true that those who believe that the world was built by an intentional creator have some fundamental difference in their thinking, but it impinges on almost nothing, right? An intelligent religious person does not imagine the hand of God directly shaping every nuance of every organism. It just wouldn't make sense to. They believe in something that is metaphorical, and the idea that time stands in for intelligence, that these two things can be interconverted, is actually a perfectly viable way of dealing with that fraction that we don't understand. And what actually the harder group to deal with are the scientific folks who believe that they are functioning without any metaphor in their belief system, without any faith on the bottom tier of the ladder. And it's just nonsense, right? When we say that there are mutations and then selection chooses among those mutations and it results in the change of something that is shrew-like into something that is bat-like, we've just said something quite implausible. And the reason we've done it is that we don't actually know the answer of the thing that stands between the mutation layer and the change in morphology. We will ultimately know it. It's not in any way any more immune to evolutionary or to scientific exploration than the gene layer was. But we are arrogant on the scientific side in pretending that we know vastly more than we actually do.
And this, I mean, I guess this is also one of the drumbeats of the book is the arrogance of moderns and of modern science in particular in imagining that if you can count it, if it can be measured, then it's the thing that is worthy of being counted and measured, and it's the only thing that we should be paying attention to. And of course, there were emergent properties and there were emergent truths. And, you know, things like a forest actually cannot be controlled by humans. And it's not going to be able to be controlled, no matter how much we wish it to be the case.
So thank you for all that. And so let's get some more fun examples from the book of ways that some more orthodontist examples, except not actually teeth.
Well,
sleep or something.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe let's talk about the change in light levels and the impact that it may be having. I mean, in fact, clearly is having on our patterns of sleep. So sleep is an amazing process. It is integral to many things that are essential to functioning. It's integral to healing processes, to cognitive processing of experience. And the problem is, as anybody who has gone camping in a remote place knows, your sleep cycles become very normal when what you've got is the sun rising and setting. And, you know, it's not unusual to be on a camping trip and it gets, you know, dark at 8:30 and, you know, by 9:30, it kind of feels like time to turn in, where if you were home, you know, maybe around midnight, you might think, yeah, I should really go to bed. And what's really going on is that we have fed information, false information, into the structures that monitor what time of day it is. Because the fact is that wavelengths of light that are available during the day are heavily in the direction of blue. And so until the invention of artificial light, it was a reasonably good mechanism for detecting whether or not the sun was shining or whether it had set and it was time to think about going into a dormant state. So by piping these wavelengths in, by effectively creating ongoing daylight situations in our indoor environments, and then in more modern times, putting absurd things like blue flashing LEDs on every electronic device, which, you know, we all agree they look kind of cool, but the fact is they're actually sending messages about the time of day and therefore where you are in your sleep-wake cycle into your mind. And, you know, you can certainly correct for that with other technological interventions. They each have a cost. Or you can become obsessive about trying to restore the distinction between the wavelengths of light that you would be getting during the day and at night. Now, there's a technological loophole in here, which is that our ancestors have, for tens of thousands of years, had access to fire. They have controlled it. And what that means is that the spectrum of light that comes from fire does not trigger the system, because presumably the system has learned to ignore it. Whereas the spectrum of light that comes from a bulb, you know, unless you choose your bulbs very carefully in the direction of warm color temperature, those bulbs do heavily trigger this. And, you know, even a single flicking on of the light at night can cause your brain to misunderstand where you are in your sleep wake cycle and prevent you from getting back to sleep.
So I would just add to that a couple of actionable things to be done that may not even be obvious from all of that, from all of that setup that Brett just gave. You know, not only are we going to be likely to entrain our sleep cycles better so that we do not need alarms to wake us up, for instance, in the morning, if we shift the light that we are exposed to at night to the red. But the earlier in the morning after we wake up that we are exposed to blue shifted light, especially if it is, you know, the blue shifted light from the early morning sun, the more awake we will be, the more present we will be, the less likely we will be to be sleepy and to be needing other enhancements to keep us awake. And just one more thing, which will probably seem pretty counterintuitive. You know, a lot of this that we're talking about right now, when we were beginning to talk about it 15 years ago, it would have seemed very, very new to people. And by now, most people have begun to hear, like, okay, I probably shouldn't be looking at screens right before I go to bed, this sort of thing. But another thing that is true is that indoor light is actually much dimmer on average than being outdoors. And so if you are someone who is working indoors and doesn't have any reason or, you know, pull from inside of you to go outside on the regular during the day, there's a good chance that you've just not been exposed to enough light. And that's also going to be disruptive of your sleep-wake cycles. And so going outside first thing in the morning And repeatedly throughout the day, if you work at something that doesn't allow you to be outside more than that, can actually help with your sleep-wake cycles. And then, you know, so much falls from that. You know, so much of health and of productivity and of creativity and of, you know, analytical competence actually is downstream of a healthy sleep-wake cycle.
Maybe the last thing to say on it, we talk in the book about the interesting fact that the experiences that one has on entheogens, hallucinogenic substances, the experiences of somebody who is suffering from schizophrenia, and our dreams all share a conspicuous resemblance. In other words, what we say in the book is that if you list the symptoms of somebody suffering from schizophrenia, they look suspiciously like somebody who is dreaming. And we don't realize this because dreaming comes with paralysis and amnesia in general. And so we don't notice the connection. But here's the question. What we say, what we hypothesize in the book, is that this may be more than a passing resemblance. And to the extent that most of us deal with the stray light basically by wrestling ourselves into sleep and, you know, maybe if we're wise, controlling those frequencies so that it's not so disruptive, it may be that some of us are more vulnerable. And then, in fact, the dream architecture, which creates these narratives in which people who don't exist are talking to us about events that aren't happening, that may be happening to some people during the day because their light levels aren't being well controlled. And, you know, again and again, when you look at places where you make an intervention that seems safe enough, and then you discover actually there are horrifying consequences downstream, right? What are we doing that is causing children to be obese, right? Is it a component of the food that we are feeding them? Is it something that is misinforming their brains? Whatever it may be, it's effectively maiming people. And for us to be obsessed with, you know, addressing it through things like, you know, low calorie drinks, for which there's no evidence that they actually do function to control anything, rather than saying, well, what caused this in the first place? How can, you know, it may be that it's too late for anybody who's already suffered this consequence, but it certainly isn't too late for anybody who has yet to be. Can we protect them?
And this is a little bit of an aside, but an example that is in the book that would seem to run in the opposite direction from the one with regard to sleep and being very careful about your light environment, especially at night, is with regard to sound and babies. Many modern parents try to produce a extremely comfortable, soundproof environment for their children to sleep in, and will do things like, you know, refusing to turn on the vacuum or the television or the stereo when the baby is sleeping. And what this does, you know, obviously the vacuum and the television and the stereo are modern inventions, but forever there have been sounds in the environment where humans live. You know, the idea that a baby would find themselves in an environment where there were no human sounds is actually potentially cause for alarm for that infant, right? The idea that you would have been safe as a helpless infant, one who can't even roll over for themselves, outside of earshot of any of the adults who love you, that's actually a very risky position. And so not only does producing a totally sound-free environment for your child make it likely that they will have a more difficult time falling asleep themselves, except in a totally quiet environment later on, but it's also very likely to cause anxiety in that child. And in this case, anxiety is meaningful. You know, you want to create a human, if you have chosen to become a parent, who you understand to be utterly and completely dependent on you, the parents, the adults who love you, early on. But with every passing day, week, month, year, they become more and more capable of going out into the world, taking on risk, experiencing things they've never seen before, with that solid foundation of, I know that the people who love me have my back. And that is not done by producing a perfectly safe and comfortable environment at the beginning. It's done by producing an environment which is full of love, but also full of experiences and sounds and other sensory inputs that any organism might be running into as a young thing.
In fact, Heather alludes there to another important fact, which is if your children are protected from risk, they won't be able to manage it as adults. And so while many of us have been handed the idea that part of our job as a parent is to protect a child from all risk, that can't possibly be right. What you want is to hedge out the really serious risks while allowing a certain amount of error, because that's how you get good at dealing with the hazards that you will face in adulthood.
I'm laughing over here because I often think about how it is a miracle that children survive. Like building tree houses 50 feet up a tree when you're 7 years old. I mean, it's just, it's absolute madness. And children, yes, it's so clear that there is this sort of managed terror that you're doing children do just the most insane, stupid thing, including myself. I jumped off the roof. Why would you jump off the roof? And in my case, I did it because I saw them do it in movies. And they would land and roll, and everything's fine. And
I also jumped off the roof.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, this is maybe not the best example of this, but the fact is, it sounds like you both jumped off the roof when you were young enough that there was a lesson to be learned, and that it didn't permanently alter your capacity as a human being, and that's the point.
Yes.
Yeah. The fact is, I mean, we actually, in our house, we have two boys, and they, if we had them here in the studio right now, they could tell you that we have certain rules in our house. And among those rules are, you are allowed to break your arm or your leg. It's not a good thing to do, but nobody's going to look at you and say, how could you possibly? You are not allowed to damage your skull, your eyes, your neck, your back. Right. These are things that are forbidden, and it doesn't mean we wouldn't take care of them if it happened. But I think the point is, it makes sense to put them in a separate category.
Right. Not all injury is the same. Not all risk is the same. You learn to manage risk by being exposed to risk. And if you want a child who has 100% chance of being alive on their 18th birthday, then you wrap them in a bubble and you protect them from everything. But what are the chances that they have an 18-year-old brain that's capable of going out and navigating the world at that point? Basically zero. So you take some risk, you accept some risk. And, you know, I say this as someone who has, you know, never lost a child, you know, it's impossible to imagine. But still, what you want is people who are capable of going out into the world and doing good in that world, not people who are just alive.
And, you know, we took students into very risky circumstances. In our last year, our second to last year of teaching at Evergreen, we went for 11 weeks into Ecuador. We went into the most diverse habitat on Earth in the Amazon, in an extremely remote place. And the dangers there are very real. And, you know, we were very honest with them that there was a risk to all of us that, you know, and in fact, we had a rule on our trip, which every student knew, which was nobody goes home in a box. It didn't mean you could hedge that out completely, but it needed to be on the table that was the kind of hazards that existed. And therefore, one was responsible for thinking carefully when making decisions, which does lead to something that we do talk about in the book. Which has to do with the way a person who is developing a model for the world, you can become excellent at managing risk if you pay attention to the close calls that you have and you process them well, right? So there's an instinct that we have, or maybe it's part of our modern mythology, that if something bad has almost happened, but you were unscratched, then the point is, well, maybe there's nothing to learn. Maybe I did it right. But if the thing really puts you in jeopardy, it's the wrong lesson. The lesson is, look, if the difference between what did happen to me and what might have happened to me is luck, then I screwed up and I need to process this at the full strength of what might have happened. And if you do that, you'll realize that the threats to us exist in a Bell distribution, a normal distribution, and that one can infer the threats that you haven't yet seen from how frequently you encounter something less severe. And to the extent that you're constantly having accidents that put you at some significant risk, you are doing something wrong, and it's on you to figure out what it is.
That's great. I want to go back to the sleep thing for a second, because it's I have my entire life suffered from industrial strength insomnia, and with the exception of 2 weeks. And when I lived in Spokane, there was an ice storm that knocked out electricity for 2 weeks. It's exactly your point.
Wow.
Yep.
So it was the middle of winter. So, and it's fairly far north in Spokane. So if sun went down about 4, the electricity's out, everything's out. I would go to bed by, and I had plenty of firewood, so I was nice and toasty. And I would go to bed by 5. I would wake up at 2 in the morning and look at my little alarm clock and think, little wind-up alarm clock, and think, I have like 5 more hours till daylight. And after about 4 or 5 days, this was honestly the only time in my life when I have felt refreshed. And then the electricity comes back on, and this is how addicted I am, is I know I have this, and then the electricity comes back on. It's like, okay, it's time to not be able to sleep again.
Right.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of lessons in that story. I mean, A, to the extent, you know, it's probably multiple things that were contributing to your anomalous ability to sleep in that case. One, the distractions are fewer because so many of our distractions are dependent on electrical technology. And to the light, not only your own light, but the stray light that would have been coming in from whatever your neighbors were doing, would have been controlled by that. And so at some level, once you spot what's actually wrecking your life, you become determined to do something about it, because the gains for having successfully controlled, for example, stray light coming from out of your house and the wavelengths of light in your house and how you use them, the benefits to being able to sleep well every night are so great that once you've accomplished it, you understand how important it was. Until you do, this is all kind of abstract. I must say I did not know for who knows how long that I had a severe wheat allergy. And the problem with a wheat allergy, at least mine, is that in order to discover what happens if it's not being triggered, you have to purge wheat from your diet for a very long time. It has to clear your system, or maybe it's the inflammation that has to clear. But, you know, once you experience the difference, oh, it's worth essentially any effort to avoid the thing that's hurting you.
I like what you said very much, except you are presuming that I am a reasonable and rational person.
You know, we don't know you very well, but I at least think that presumption is accurate.
I think you are a comparatively reasonable
oh, for sure.
Person. Yes. But no, yes, people are not inherently. I mean, you know, actually, the irony here, Derek, is that people aren't rational in the sense that we would like to imply when we say that sort of thing. But given people whose culture, whose upbringing is well matched to an environment in which their ancestors have lived for a very long time, they are not constantly struggling against the world in the way we moderns do. And so to the extent that many of us are find ourselves at odds with even the most basic structures that we are expected to deal with, that has a lot to do with hypernovelty.
So we only have like 10 minutes left, and I have, as well as a wind down question later, there are two notes I took reading the book that I want to run by. So we're going to do a big segue here. The first one is, you write about the relationship between genetic and epigenetic phenomena, and you call that the Omega Principle. What is the Omega Principle? What is genetic and epigenetic phenomena? What's that whole story?
We'll do the quick version. Genetic phenomena is information stored in the genes. Epigenetic literally means above the genome, and it's all of the layers of regulation that exist above our genes. Most prominently, from the point of view of our book, is culture. Right? Your culture controls effectively the way your genes are expressed in the world. They control how you spend your time, what you pursue, what you avoid. But there's also an epigenetic layer that is molecular, that controls the expression of genes very directly.
And which is what most people mean when they run in, when they say it or they run into it in the modern.
Right. In modern times, when people say epigenetic, they almost inherently mean this molecular layer. But Heather and I are very careful to say, actually, there are rules, evolutionary rules, that govern the entire epigenetic layer, which includes culture. And culture is the story for human beings. Right. We make the argument that though we are not blank slates, we are definitely not. We are the blankest slates that selection has ever produced on this planet, and that there's a reason for that. That's not arbitrary. So the Omega principle is a description of the relationship between the epigenetic layers, including culture, and the underlying genes. And the reason we've chosen omega, a Greek letter, is to evoke pi, another Greek letter. Pi specifies the relationship between the diameter and the circumference of a circle. And the important point is it's an obligate relationship. Every circle has the same relationship between those two parameters. And omega is an obligate relationship between the epigenetic layers, including culture, and the genes. And the relationship has two pieces. One, the epigenetic layer, including culture, is faster evolving, because it's written in a way that changes more quickly. And
within, not just between generations.
Right. Within, yes, because it moves horizontally, the evolution is extremely rapid. But it is subordinate in its objective to the underlying genes. And the reason for that is because to the extent that your culture, for example, started doing things that did not serve the genes' interest, were they to sign you up for behaviors that would waste your time and prevent you from doing things that would spread your genes are in an excellent position, because they are upstream, to shut down the degree to which you are cultural, right? You can't force an oak tree to do anything by, you know, spewing culture at it. It's totally immune to culture, and biologically almost all creatures are totally immune to culture. The fact that we are so prone to take things up at the cultural layer tells us that the culture, any long-standing feature, any long-standing complex expensive feature of culture is there because it served the gene's interest.
That's great. Heather, did you want to add anything, or are you good?
No, I think that was a terrific summary.
Okay, so my other out of left field one is, quote, look out for Chesterton's fence and invoke the precautionary principle in messing with ancestral systems. Remember this, just because you can doesn't mean you should. So what is Chesterton's fence? What's the precautionary principle? And why is that your advice?
Right. So G.K. Chesterton was an early 20th century philosopher, I think is how he would have been identified, maybe a political philosopher, who wrote, among many other things, if you walk up to a fence with a friend and it appears to be in your way and you say, I want to get rid of it, your friend, if he is a good friend, should say to you, what is it there for? And if you can't answer what its function is, there's no way that he should facilitate your getting rid of it. The idea being, you know, to extend it out into metaphorical space, the idea being that when we encounter things, structures in ourselves or structures in society, that we think we've outgrown or are unnecessary, we need at the very least to be able to identify what its function was purported to be, you know, actually was, if it's, you know, an anatomical or physiological feature of an organism, or was purported to be, at least in its origin, if it's a societal characteristic, before even considering whether or not it is in fact time to get rid of it. And so, for instance, we tell the story in the book of early 20th century doctors, upon having realized wrongly, as it turns out, that the appendix was a vestigial organ that had no value, they took that even a step further and decided that the colon, the entire large intestine, had no value. And there was a move for some number of years in Western medicine to simply take out people's large intestines because we didn't in fact need them. Now, this is an obvious failure of evolutionary thinking at many levels, but it's obvious to us only with the hindsight of 100+ years. And so we would ask, what of those types of errors are we making now that we don't have the hindsight on? And so maybe you want to pick up precautionary principle as a sort of corollary.
Well, I want to say, you know, Chesterton's fence is really the negative version of the precautionary principle, which says that when we do something new, we should presume it is dangerous until proven otherwise. Chesterton's fence effectively says that when you find a structure, you should presume that it is useful until you've established that its use is no longer meaningful. But I would just say it's now very easy. Everybody can see that a medical professional who thought the large intestine was superfluous was obviously wrong then and should obviously have been ignored based on the fact that that intestine wouldn't be there had it not had an important purpose. But this is much less obvious to us when we look at things like, monogamous pair bonding and marriage, right? How often have we all heard somebody say, well, you know, it's just a piece of paper. Why do you need the government to sanction your relationship? Right. There's all kinds of reasons to think that, maybe the structure of marriage is pointless. Right. And that you could dispense with it. But of course, there is also something very important about even a wedding. Right. Having your community gather, and hear you say very unambiguous, profound things about another person actually creates an obstacle to your extracting yourself from that relationship, which therefore is likely to protect any children you have produced from hastiness on your part. It puts everybody in your community on notice that that the people who have signed up for this bond are off limits from the point of view of mating and dating. All of these things are very positive, and to the extent that we will ultimately discover that monogamy is the key to a safe, fair, functional, non-warlike society, we need to recognize that, you know, our instinct that there's no point to a marriage or a wedding is in error, just like the idea that you could get rid of the large intestine without harm.
Yeah, that's good.
So we have just a couple minutes left, and I know you've done this a half dozen times, but I don't think one can do this enough. Can you sum up? Okay, I don't mean to be this crass, but the second part's crass. The first part isn't. First part is, so what's the point of your book? And second part is, why should people buy it? And that's the crass part.
All right. Maybe
you go first.
All right. The point of the book is, at every level, we moderns are much less healthy than we should be. We are psychologically, physically, socially unwell. And this unwellness all shares a cause that is not, nobody ever tells you. The cause of the unwellness is a mismatch between what we are built for and what we experience. And treating these things symptomatically does not function, right? So most of us go through life experiencing all of this disease effectively and scratch our heads over it. And, you know, probably we even think it's evidence that evolution isn't very effective, because after all, if it were effective, why are we suffering with all this stuff? The recognition that, no, in fact, these are new maladies, that they come from hypernovelty, and that therefore the answer is to be extremely cautious about what you let into your life and what you let into your children's developmental environment. That's a revelation for many of us.
Yeah. I guess I would say this book emerged in part because our students over the course of 15 years were asking us to put into a succinct, shareable form some of the kinds of lessons that they were hearing from us in the classroom. And the reason that our classrooms didn't look like typical biology classrooms or college classrooms at all, because they didn't involve a lot of memorization. This approach to the world does not require that you memorize a whole litany of things. It does require a sort of a different lens, you know, the evolutionary lens in our language. But it's simplifying, and it's freeing, and it's fun. And it allows you to explore with a kind of abandon and a seeking of serendipity in which you're looking for pattern and meaning in the world that for us and for many generations of our students also, we have found to be the best approach to living in modernity that allows for an appreciation of what has come before and also an anticipation with excitement and, you know, a little bit of dread as well, but hopefulness about what's to come in the future.
And I guess I would just say in closing, our experience with this model and what it has done for us and others that we have shown it to is that it both simplifies and improves life. And we expect many who read the book will discover that it has that impact for them as well.
So since both of you are too modest and also uncrass to simply say why people should buy the book, I'll do it for you.
Right.
Which is that one of the things I loved about this book is it takes, as you did in this interview, it takes really complex ideas and presents them clearly and then combines them. Okay, one of my problems with advanced physics, I loved my first year of physics and I hated the rest of it. And the reason is because in the first year of physics, you learn how when somebody throws a rock, you learn how to describe the path. I can see it, but I honestly couldn't see Gauss-Jordan equations. The advanced physics was much of it. I kept saying to the instructor, how does this apply to my life? And you do a wonderful, I've never seen this before. You do a wonderful job of taking these complex evolutionary questions and mixing them with direct examples that everybody is going to experience in their own lives. And I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Thank
Wonderful.
You so much.
Sounds like it works just as intended.
Yeah, that's fabulous. We really appreciate that.
Well, I would like to thank you for your work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Heather Hying and Brett Weinstein. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.